Hello, listeners. One quick announcement before we start. I will be speaking at the Baltimore Book Festival on Saturday, September 13th. The writer James Baldwin is one of my personal heroes. Among other things, he might be the best essayist in the English language ever. The first Baldwin biography in 30 years was published last month. It's called Baldwin, A Love Story, and it is astounding. If you care about literature, history, the civil rights movement, or the sometimes tortured process of making great art, grab that biography now. I will interview this brilliant book's author, Nicholas Boggs, about everything in it and the reasons he and his great work make me feel inadequate. That's Saturday, September 13th at 4:15 p.m. on the 31st Street stage, and it's free. Go to baltimorebookfest.com for a complete schedule. BaltimoreBookFest.com. A heartfelt thanks to the City Lit Project and the Baldwin Prize, two of the organizations that made this session at the festival possible.
Helping people focus enough on how to make enough money in the business so that it could be sustainable was hard because a lot of people were into the dream and didn't want to look at the money.
Welcome to Money Honestly. I'm Lionel Foster. Why do people start businesses? I work in venture capital, so I assumed it was to make money or to create something massive or sometimes, you know, out of ego. That's a thing. But Kate Mirren, in her wonderfully gentle way, showed me the reasons are so much more varied than I thought. Kate founded and ran the Office of Innovation and Equitable Development within Washington, D.C.'s local government. During her tenure, she estimates her team worked with 20,000 current and would-be entrepreneurs, people who pursued business ownership to provide a service for their community because they faced limited employment opportunities, and also because they had an idea they just had to see all the way through. But many of these brave, determined people, even when they grew sizable enterprises, kept hitting emotional and psychological walls that Kate came to realize had to do with trauma. Trauma around money. And that is the thing I heard that made it clear Kate had to be on this podcast. Money plus deep, unprocessed feelings? Yes, please. It's why you subscribed, right? Let's go. All right, Kate, welcome to Money Honestly. Thanks for joining.
Lionel, it's fantastic to be here, and thank you for having me today.
All right. So what's your money origin story?
My money origin story. I'm probably going to start it a little bit in media res, sort of in the middle of the story, because I hadn't really thought about it before you asked me. And we had been talking a little bit about a training I'd been giving about money and trauma. And in that training, I've been thinking a lot about other people's trauma and not necessarily mine, but recognizing I think the reason I gave it probably was related to mine. And I want to start this also with a question that I always started that training with, which was to ask people think of the word money and what was the first word that came to mind. And it was always interesting to hear other folks to say things that were either negative or positive. Some people would say opportunity. Some people would say difficulty, not enough.
Sounds like it was negative or positive, but never neutral.
Well, and that's where mine, I think, is interesting because mine is always tool. That money is a tool in order to do things. And you can do, just like with many other tools, you could do good or bad things with a tool. But kind of digging back into that, I grew up on a farm. I grew up on a dairy farm in upstate New York with five older brothers. And it's interesting because if folks haven't lived on a farm, it's something you have a concept of, but not a real deep concept of often. But living on a farm in the U.S., in an industry that was waning. So let's recognize that, you know, dairy farming is a difficult set of farming. Small farms are going away, consolidating. But my parents kept that farm going throughout the entire time that all of their kids were growing up. And that was hard. You know, I would say I was not a kid who got an allowance, did have to work. Everyone had to work on the farm. That was part of what was necessary for things to happen. My parents weren't able to take vacations. You worked when you were sick because cows have to be fed and they have to be milked. And there's just no other option. And so growing up and thinking about money, I didn't think about it very often because I didn't have any. And then there was a lot of difficulty that my parents often didn't have a lot. And so money was just the tool that we needed to get things when we needed them. But we also tried very hard to make sure that, you know, if money was going to be tight and it would happen, that we had other means to get the things that we needed. So my parents did have land, which is something that was of value.
I am curious. You said you didn't think a lot about money because you didn't have much. Mm-hmm. But I didn't grow up with loads of money either. Mm-hmm. But I did find myself, I did live within close proximity to people and institutions that appeared to have much greater access to money. And I fell into that trap of comparison at a very mm-hmm. early age. Did that not happen to you?
I think I had a lot less access to seeing and knowing. Like, I would have seen things through television, but we didn't have cable. So I only would have seen things through three channels. We didn't even have NBC. The area in which I lived, which was rural, we didn't necessarily have a lot of people with a lot of wealth. There were some people who had a little bit more. I would say they were probably middle class, maybe upper middle class. We often thought of them as a little bit snobby. That was there. But, you know, even access to stores was less. And so I would go to the grocery store. We did have a mall, but the ability to go shopping, to see wealth, and to really see it directly, I was a lot farther away from that. Definitely in the space where other kids in school knew I was on a farm. And they might have attributed certain things to wealth, but also there was just sort of a feeling about farm kids and a feeling that farm kids were less or different or bad. Often, you know, they would bring up, you know, farm smell. You know, so those were all of the different layers and things. But also most of the people in the area, if they didn't live on a farm, they had family history on it as well. And so definitely as a small child, we would garden so we'd have enough food. We had the farm, so we would always have beef and other things. And so for me, money was a tool in order to do additional things. And some of that, I think, is also because some of the struggles that my parents went through up until I went to college, they would have kept from us a little bit more. You know, they'd often say we can't do certain things, but they would also, a lot of things that maybe we might want to do if we had more money, they maybe saw as against some of their values as well. So it's sort of a different type of choice.
So when did you reach a point when you had maybe a more acute, if it ever happened, a more acute awareness of where your family stood financially versus many others?
When I was going to college. Okay. So I went to college. I decided that I wanted to leave rural America. I wanted to live in a city. I wanted to experience the city. I wanted to know a city. And so I chose to go to George Washington University in Washington, D.C. But even in the process of getting ready to go to school, my mother spent a lot of time on the phone with the financial aid office because they did not understand farm finances at all. So I did understand certain things about the finances through that. And I think where the major disconnect was is that farms have a lot of gross income, but then they also have a lot of expenses. And so then net, there's very little left. And that was something she would have to explain to the financial aid officers a lot. And then when I did get to school, there was just a lot of things I couldn't do, even just like going out to a basic dinner. I worked my first year, it was about 10 hours a week. But then the rest of the years that I was in school, I worked 35 hours a week in addition to doing a full-time load at a four-year university. And I think it was at that period of time of seeing, you know, there were just simple things I couldn't do. And towards the end of it, there were even spaces, you know, and I think this was the space where I think money as a tool comes even stronger to me. You know, I think there was a period in time in which I couldn't afford enough food, right? So, you know, what does the space of hunger start to mean? And what do you start to think about things related to that? And so I started, one of the things that kind of came through strongly in college was the space of people who have money thinking they're better than people who do not. Mm-hmm. And whether I believed that directly or believed that in the background, I think left me vulnerable in my 20s.
So you grew up in a community and on a farm that grew food. You mm-hmm. had direct, very tangible access to food, and you get to college and you go through a period where you have too little access to food. There seems like a cruel irony there. Did it strike you that way at that time?
I don't think I was thinking that deeply about it. I was just concerned with the immediate and concerned with trying to make it through. And, you know, one of the things that I will say, one of the reasons I chose to come to D.C. is because I did have a brother who was here. And, you know, I was choosing between New York City and Washington, D.C. And I chose D.C. because I didn't want to be so far away from family and safety net. And eventually I did reach out to my brother for help. And it took me a little bit before I did that. But I think...
Why did you hesitate?
Thinking back on it, I probably didn't want to admit that I had gotten to that situation and thought that I should work harder in order to make it work better. Yeah. That like the very small choices that I might have made of like, oh, I chose last month to have a slightly more expensive meal, so now I can't eat this month. Like, that was a bad choice that I made. I should have known better.
Wow. What was his response when you went to him for help?
Oh, immediately help.
Yeah.
He was like, being in college is hard and you don't have a lot of income, and this makes sense. And sure.
Yeah.
No questions asked, no thoughts.
Okay. Yeah. He made it super simple.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for a living?
I help entrepreneurs. I help people who are trying to create businesses in order to change the world.
Say more, what kind of entrepreneurs and what kinds of businesses?
For the last 10 years, I worked for the city in DC and I ran the innovation. I created and then ran the Innovation and Equitable Development Office, which was all about removing barriers to entrepreneurship. And so that started with a program specifically supporting returning citizens, individuals with a criminal record, in order to start their own businesses, recognizing all the barriers within the workforce. But that quickly grew to anyone who wanted to be building a business and was facing a barrier. So I worked with over 20,000 entrepreneurs in the district. I think we moved about $12 million in grants to over 1,000 small businesses. We did hundreds of trainings and technical assistance hours. And I would say the majority of the businesses that I was working with, early stage entrepreneurs, and they were in a space of learning entrepreneurship and probably a lot of social entrepreneurship. I think one thing that's really relevant to the conversation here is that access to capital was always an important topic of conversation. But within that topic of conversation, helping people focus enough on how to make enough money in the business so that it could be sustainable was hard, because a lot of people were into the dream and didn't want to look at the money.
That's fascinating. So they were organized and purposeful enough to reach out for the support of your office, your institution. Mm-hmm. So logistically, they had that much on the ball. Yet, in your perspective, they weren't focused enough on the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Frequently. And that's what led me to eventually develop the training on trauma. Because I was trying to understand like why that focus wasn't there. And like, where were the blockers that people had in thinking about money and money related to the business? An awful lot of businesses and entrepreneurs that I met, that one of the things that they wanted to do was to provide an affordable service or product to their community. And in order to do that, would take losses. Mm-hmm. And maybe losses that were unsustainable. But they saw the value of something being available in their community.
I was just about to ask, you mentioned these entrepreneurs were focused on the dream. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the dream for some of them was providing a service for their community. What were some of the other dreams you heard about?
I would say the most consistent dreams were to provide a space for youth. So I did a lot of work in Washington, D.C., and it was over the entire city, but also a lot of focused work on areas of the city with less economic development. For many people, they recognized a deep need to support youth within the community. And so they wanted to offer jobs. They wanted to offer a space to gather where there was safety. Another very consistent idea was that people wanted to build laundromats, because there are laundromat deserts and there are just spaces where there's not enough access to be able to wash clothes. A huge number of people who wanted to close the gap on access to affordable food, affordable childcare. Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I did not expect to hear this. So many of the motivations of the entrepreneurs you encountered, they were forward-leaning with a social, with a public purpose. Why the for-profit entrepreneurial route for them instead of maybe the nonprofit route?
Well, I would say that, and I asked this question to thousands of people, and I used to ask people to raise their hand during group trainings, whether people saw a nonprofit as a business. IRS tax code clearly does not. Almost to a person, people saw nonprofits as businesses. And so it was sort of an interesting space. They're just like, it is an organization, it gets money, it does things. And for many people, they hadn't heard of the concept of social entrepreneurship. They, you know, simply knew that there were organizations that came together and then created things. And a lot of people did want to start nonprofits. And one of the things that we trained people with on social entrepreneurship was that the for-profit structure can be faster and easier to set up. So if you get a business model and it does good, it has a triple bottom line, you don't have to have the governing board. Fundraising for nonprofits can be difficult in different ways. And so a nonprofit can be a much harder lift to get started at the beginning.
So you end up in a situation where you decide your team needs to offer some training, a space to talk around money and trauma. I want to take this in stages. First, what led you all to that point? How did you get there?
Yeah. My team had always had an access to capital portfolio. And so a lot of that was for supporting small businesses, how to help people get loan ready and think about loans, very traditional debt. That's very common in small business development. But, you know, we would often give trainings and sort of be in a space where I felt people needed to take two or three steps back. And this started actually at the very beginning of my coming in to do entrepreneurship work. I went to other trainings, sitting there with my law degree, and I would be like, I don't know what you just said to me. Like, people would talk about small business access to capital and they would use jargon and they would talk about specific loan products. And it was just, so I had actually had an earlier set of trainings that I
when you said it was just shoop, you
over my
waved
head,
your
yeah.
hand over your head. It went right over your head. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah. And I think within that, I set a set of trainings called Landscape on Access to Capital, which is just helping people think about what are all the ways that you get capital into a business. And then, but we started realizing that beyond that, another challenge, because we were issuing grants, is what is money management in a business? How do you actually refine a business model so that it makes money? And how do you understand those pieces? And I would not only give my own trainings, but I would go and lead panels for other discussions. And I would find that, you know, I would meet businesses that were making several hundred thousand dollars a year, and we would do a very basic discussion about loans and money management. And they would be like, thank you. No one has ever broken it down this way before, just into simple terms. And so, you know, we first started on just sort of confidence building of what does it mean to approach money in your business? And then as we just heard people hit barrier after barrier, it seemed that people were just hitting blockers. And I did find there was Experian did a study in 2023, just looking at the number of people who reported having sort of financial trauma. That was 68% of Americans said that they had, you know, sort of financial trauma, and it's much higher amongst Gen Z and millennials. So Gen Z is 73% and millennials is 77%. And it's just sort of recognizing that trauma comes in a lot of different ways and then sticks with people a lot of different ways. Like, we had always thought to be trauma aware. We never had training and money to become trauma informed, but to be trauma aware because of that very first program that we started, which is supporting returning citizens.
And just to quickly explain, and I could use your help with this, trauma informed, I imagine, means you have an understanding of what some people's blockers and triggers might be, and then you can build your programming and support to fully take that into account. Maybe trauma aware might be a level lower than that. There is the awareness on your part, but you may not necessarily be able to outfit all of your programming and services to account for it.
Yeah, we didn't want to overclaim our ability to support. But, you know, being able to start with awareness and start with what are some of the blockers that people might recognize in themselves so that they could then think about what support they might need.
Yeah. Okay. And I got to pause for a moment and say, you know, my day job is in finance. I work in venture capital. The profile of entrepreneur you're describing has serious overlaps with what I see on a daily basis and then some big divergences. Mm-hmm. It's not the stereotypical entrepreneur that I and maybe other people often imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the majority of businesses across the country are small businesses. Many small businesses don't scale, and many are very much community-based, sometimes in a space where they got into entrepreneurship because their family was in entrepreneurship, or entrepreneurship of necessity because work was not an option. But then there are also the dreamers who, you know, they see a problem, One of my old directors, one of my old bosses, I used to have a phrase, which is, you know, entrepreneurs are the people who can't not. They can't not do this thing. It is stuck in their head that they want to do this thing, and they're going to think about it forever until they do it. And so there's a drive behind
in the
a lot
case
of
of
people.
people, you said there was a subset of people for whom work was not an option. They had to become their own boss. I imagine some of them might have been previously incarcerated, so they needed a different avenue.
I would say that that's one of those avenues. Also, we continue to better understand health and mental health and other spaces. Workplaces may not always be accommodating, and work schedules and other spaces to the needs that someone has.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you and your team are offering a lot of services and support. You're doing a lot. So you're seeing a lot. You're seeing some blind spots that people that are catching up with folks. You're figuring out how to account for that. You decide to offer a training around money and trauma. What do you call it? And do you put trauma in the title?
I did. In part because, you know, if someone doesn't want to talk about it, that's your first way to know that you don't want to be part of this training. But a lot of people did sign up for it. And I'd say one angle in which a lot of people signed up for it was actually folks who were thinking about equity investment later. What did it mean to approach equity investment, even if they were far off from what that was and they were going to be in sort of debt now, but sort of in a space of how to think about the whole, again, the whole landscape. Because
what's the tide of people thinking about a potential equity investment, outside equity investment later? Why might they in particular sit for your class?
I think they were looking for a broader understanding of the entire landscape around money and finance.
Okay.
And so a lot of financial trainings are very limited in scope and limited in belief. And it's sort of like steps 1, 2, 3, do these and then get outcome X. Whereas if you are trying to think about how to build a larger scale company, you want to soak in a lot of information about how does money work.
Yeah. Okay.
And those are two different conversations. How do I accomplish one money goal is very different than how do I understand how money works.
Right. How money works, and in the case of this training, how I relate to money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How was the course structured? How many sessions? Mm-hmm. You know, what were your goals and objectives?
Yeah, it was 1 2-hour session. You know, and I think I originally developed it on a prompt from Halcyon House and then realized it would be really helpful. It was 1 2-hour session, somewhat discussion-based because most of my trainings were discussion-based, but also a little bit more information since, you know, it was in a deck and not everyone wanted to respond. But, you know, I think one of the things that we always tried to instill for any entrepreneur is that whenever you are having a discussion with someone else about money, it's your money. If they aren't using terms and language that make sense to you, ask them to explain it. And if they're not going to, it's not a good deal. And so always trying to reposition to the footing of equal footing in a position in a discussion about money, whether it's a loan, whether it's a contract, whatever that is. And when those terms aren't good for you, walk away. And so one of the things that's hard for a lot of entrepreneurs is that sometimes the first money that's offered them somewhere is not good money. It could be a scam. It can come at high rate. That, you know, it could be an inappropriate equity deal. And walking away from money when it's offered is hard. And so how do you prepare yourself for that?
That's very practical. Mm-hmm. And I imagine hugely useful. I'm imagining people confronting some stuff they might not have known was there. Mm-hmm. One, is that right? And if so, how did that show up?
After we did the piece, just asking people to have the first word reaction, like what is that first word that you think of with money? We then had a screen. It wasn't all inclusive, but I would say it was about 8 or 10 things which could show up for you if you are facing financial trauma. It could be avoidance behaviors, or it could be shutting down, or could be hypervigilance. But, you know, if you are seeing one of these things potentially, being able to assess and know yourself so that you can figure out either one, can you move past it? And if not, do you have a mitigation strategy some way so that you understand that this is affecting you? And so I think within all of that, We didn't necessarily get into people's individual personal stories of trauma. We got to a space of saying, if you are facing trauma, you are not alone. You are like the majority of Americans. And if that's normal, then it just becomes a question of how do you want to deal with it if you think that you have.
How long were you part of delivering these trainings?
That was about a year. I did leave district government after about 10 years. It was time for someone else to run the innovation office and to continue building that and taking it forward. But I would say probably provided the training 6 to 8 times in different settings. And it built on a lot of individual conversations, because the other thing that I used to do was just on Wednesdays sit at our central library and anyone could come talk to me about entrepreneurship, which is why I met so many entrepreneurs. And there was always different threads about money, confidence, access to capital that would come into every one of those conversations.
Do you know if the training is still offered?
I don't think that it is.
I'm imagining you sitting down during what I'm calling your office hours with entrepreneurs, people you may be meeting for the very first time. I'm in a field where I too often have to have a lot of short, ideally efficient conversations with strangers. Mm-hmm. And they tell me some of their dreams and what they're building. And in some of those instances, it seems clear to me that they should not continue. They should probably do something else. Or at the very least, my firm would be of the position that this is not something we would support at this time. Mm-hmm. Did you hear ideas that just didn't seem viable?
Always, I think there is a kernel in idea that someone can come back to and continue to transform it. So I think most of the time I would say they were not yet, and maybe not this way, but this is part of backing up an entrepreneur towards their why. Why are you doing this? And then the biggest thing that would always encourage entrepreneurs to do is talk to more and more and more people and get more and more and more feedback and refine it. And, you know, within that, often letting people know that, like, you thought you were going to start a business to do this one thing. And then you went and talked to 100 people and you realized the thing that you're going to do is a little different. So maybe not completely off base, but it's a little different because business, you don't operate a business in isolation. You operate it within a network and a community and an economy. And so it needs to be a living, breathing, moving thing.
So you create and offer this course. You're putting other people in a position where they can come face to face with some of their money concerns and maybe at least begin to imagine how they can deal with them. Did doing this work put you in front of some of your money fears, some of your own money trauma?
I mean, I think yes, you know, and I think within that, first just acknowledging that trauma is real, and, you know, sometimes people overcome trauma, but a lot of times you just live with it. And so being able to live with it. And, you know, I went through a difficult period in my 20s. I would say that I didn't really believe in myself, in part because my partner at the time told me I didn't come from as much money. And so within that, he was smarter and better. And I didn't agree with that on face, but it was always in the background. And I think that made me very susceptible. It made me susceptible to being controlled in ways that eventually I realized did not line up with my values. So being told I had less value, I believed it a little bit too much in the background.
I'm so sorry you had to deal with that.
It's, you know, I think a lot of folks go, through that in a lot of different ways. You know, one of the things that and it's funny because I don't think I'm a good study of religious history, but I'm always fascinated by this one form, I guess it was a form of Christianity in Europe called Calvinism. I don't know.
Predestination.
Yeah. And just this idea that people believe that with more money, they could buy their way into heaven. And I don't think that we are away from that concept. I think we stopped talking about Calvinism, but I think that it's something there just stuck with a lot of the culture.
You mentioned this difficult period in your 20s, even if you didn't believe what your partner was saying explicitly, some of it has seeped in. It took a hold someplace. How did you end up moving through and possibly beyond those beliefs?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the end of that relationship ties to the start of the work that I did for the city. And I will say that it was a realization of my values and what I thought to be important in the world. And so I had started the work on thinking about building Aspire to Entrepreneurship, which is the program that supports returning citizen entrepreneurs. And I did that because I went to a hackathon from a group called Mission Launch, in which they were looking at that question. And I just decided it was incredibly valuable. It needed to happen. It was an important topic of justice. You know, we would look at the entire history of incarceration and go into that separately. And I was talking with said partner about that. And they said something that just like the scales dropped from my eyes when they said it, which, you know, they were like, why do you want to invest time in people that society has thrown away? They're garbage. And this hurt me to my core. I was like, you are not the person that I thought you were. Our values have completely different alignment. That is false. That is horrible. I do not want to be associated with that thinking. It is deeply wrong. And then that allowed me to see all of the other beliefs that had been building up. But, you know, that breaking point of values misalignment that was just so strong, and the way in which the person who thought that money made you who you were, the way that manifested in other ways, it broke. And so I left that and worked to build up the other office. And I would say that in many ways, I think it saved my life. And, you know, I had the honor of working with so many people here in DC who are doing awesome things. And it might take them 10 years to do it, but, you know, they have a belief in community. They have a belief in doing good things in the world. And, you know, was able to see how that can align with business and that can align with using money as a proper tool to achieve those values and those ends.
Yeah. Well, part of what I'm hearing is you had a very personal breakthrough, which put you in a position and gave you a lot of the drive to maybe help other people on their journey as well. And, you know, build some infrastructure around their capacity to do that. So, well done.
It was a journey.
Given your journey, given where you started, was there ever anything you wanted, maybe when you were younger, that you feared you might never be able to afford? And if you're brave enough to offer one, I might offer one myself.
Yeah, and I think for me, it was always just wanting to have a decent life where, you know, I felt like I was comfortable. And, you know, being afraid that I would not achieve that.
I think for me, it was, will I ever have enough money to have a real safety net? Because it felt for so much of my life that if I didn't work hard enough or keep going or climb, it felt the whole time like I was climbing without a net. So, you know, I had no choice but to create some momentum and keep going because the alternative was too dangerous.
I completely feel that. For my current work, I recently just took a trip to Detroit, and it was interesting. I didn't book a hotel. I was like, I'm going to go to this event and then I'll see what happens. And you know, it's the first time I've ever traveled without having everything planned out in my entire life. And I was talking to one of my brothers about this, and they were like, that stems from your like lack of safety net at other points in life. That, you know, a lot of people who can have easygoing travel in that way, maybe they could just stay with someone, you know, they still have a backup of like, well, if they need to, you know, they could use their parents' credit card or they can just do this. I think that was an eye-opening reflection for me that there are a lot of opportunities that maybe I haven't let into my life because I don't have the plan. I don't have the safety net to know that I can just do that.
Got it. So you're not maybe dotting every I, crossing every T. That sounds like progress to me. Is that what it felt like when you spoke to your brother? Maybe a bit of liberation. Okay. Got it. I'm thinking about doing a bit of solo summer travel. Well, I might build the trip around seeing a few people, and I'll probably do the same thing. I'll rent a car and I'll be all over with the car, but I might just play it by ear in terms of when I stay with friends and when I stay elsewhere, and you know, let's just see how I feel. I find that very liberating.
It's the kind of thing where, you know, previously if I had to count every penny, I was like, well, maybe the hotel will be too expensive, and so I won't be able to do that.
Right. Right. If money were no object, if you magically lived in a situation where you just didn't need to make any, would you be doing anything different with your career?
I don't think in terms of the big ideas, maybe in the details of, you know, exactly where I work and exactly, oh, you know, what the format of that is. I think I would have more diversified projects, but I think I would still be working to support people who are creating solutions. And another portion of my life that, you know, only opened up recently, exploring being an artist, I would probably lean into that a little bit more as well.
So given where you are, your trajectory around coming to terms with some of your norms, beliefs, sometimes misconceptions around money, growing into a different place, I'm curious, if you allow yourself to splurge nowadays, to be even a little bit irresponsible with a few dollars or a lot of dollars, what does that look like?
That mostly looks like trips, traveling and seeing new places. Sometimes it means art, and art can have a lot of different costs. So so it might be a really neat art piece, or it'll probably be a trip to a new place to see more of the world and meet more people.
I started taking up photography last year, definitely doing a lot more audio production this year. And then with photography, that bled into some video production. And who knows, my wife may or may not listen to this episode whenever it comes out. But, you know, just there's a lot of gear, you know, and you learn a little bit. And you watch too many YouTube videos and you go, oh my goodness, if I had X or Y, it would make this part of the workflow that much more efficient, or it would open something up, something I just cannot do right now. I really like that I'm in the place where, for the most part, I don't have to think twice about whether I can, you know, spend a few hundred bucks on this or that. Just do it, be happy, incorporate it, move on with your life. I try to make some good media and connect with people like Kate is worth it.
Awesome. I love that.
Is there anything I should have asked you that I did not, or anything you want to add?
I think when we think about money, I'll just kind of go back to, I looked up the etymology of value versus values before this discussion. So I was thinking it was interesting that like it's got the same root. And sort of money has a value or is a proxy for value, but values with an S is the, you know, sort of social principles. And that didn't really come into usage in English language as a sort of separate understanding until the early part of the 20th century. And I just thought that was interesting because I think sometimes we merge those concepts too much, what value money brings, what value it does not. And I'm curious about the timeline. I'm just, you know, something I'm going to go research and learn more. Why did values start to come forward at the time that it did, the early part of the 20th century?
Are you of the persuasion that maybe we need to do a bit more detangling of, you know, money versus value, be more thoughtful about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And you know, again, the idea that money is a tool, just this idea of, you know, that tool just is for whatever end you want to have. And so it itself, I do think, is neutral, as you mentioned at the beginning, but can be used for good or can be used for bad.
All right. Thanks again, Kate. This was great.
Thank you, Lionel. I appreciate it.
Music for Money Honestly is courtesy of bassist, composer, and band leader Chris Funn. It's his song Wish from the album Corner Store. You know, Money Honestly has a newsletter now. I didn't get too creative with the title. It's called The Honest Newsletter, but it's good. You can sign up at LionelFoster.com.